And so anybody who is using logic and using reason, they're already in touch in some way with the truth, seeking truth. If logic is to be used to seek truth, then anybody who seeks and finds something that is true, even outside of the church, is already in contact with the one who is the truth.
Welcome to the Strategic Families Podcast, where we challenge your family to be rooted in God's word, energized with gospel-centered purpose, and activated on mission for His kingdom. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Strategic Families Podcast. I hope all of you had a wonderful Easter with your families as we did, celebrating the glorious resurrection of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Okay, so our guest today is Dr. Christopher Perrin, co-founder and CEO of Classical Academic Press. Dr. Perrin is one of those guys I feel like I could just spend hours with, learning from, and at the end of it, be so much smarter. You'll see what I'm talking about as you listen to this interview. We get into a lot in this interview, but our main topic is logic, what it is, why it's so useful for the Christian life, and how we can bring it to bear in our parenting. And, you know, we talk about classical Christian education, but this is really about using language effectively in our everyday lives and helping our kids really use their heads to combat the bad arguments they will surely encounter in the world and embrace truth. I also had the privilege of hearing Dr. Perrin speak at a conference a couple of weeks ago, and he's just so articulate about how all of these wonderful educational concepts tie into our acknowledgement of Jesus as Lord. In other words, this is not just an academic exercise for Dr. Perrin. It all stems from a deep love for Christ. So I'm really excited for you guys to learn from him during this interview. But before we get to the interview, a couple of quick things. As a follow-up to the episodes in March that we did with Monica Irvin of the Etiquette Factory, if you have kids in or approaching the teenage years, check out our website, strategicfamilies.com, and click on resources. And there you're going to find a way to download a workshop for creating a dating slash courtship plan, which helps you walk through how you and your spouse can create a plan for your kids. Katie and I have started on this for our 13-year-old, and I'm really excited about it. Another thing we started doing in April is a regular email that we're just calling Family Support Content, which includes practical ideas to help you dive into strategic parenting. You know, listening is great, but actually putting things into practice is so much more useful. And that's what we really want to help you with, to take small steps and watch God work in and through your family. So for instance, in April's email, we have ideas on how to engage your kids while spending all that time in the car, something many families, including ours, with young kids find themselves doing. So this can be strategically used time, and we want to help you use it well. So anyway, you can sign up for that email on the homepage of our website, strategicfamilies.com. All right, so lastly, if you haven't already, don't forget to hit the subscribe button so you can be notified of future episodes. And if you would, please, it would be awesome if you could leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Okay, on with the show.
Well, Dr. Christopher Perrin, welcome to the podcast.
It's so good to be here. Thanks for having me, Graham.
Excellent. I'm really looking forward to this. Thank you so much for coming on. Okay, so before we get into our topic for today, could you just introduce yourself to our listeners, tell us who you are, what you do for a living, and of course, tell us about your family.
Sure. Well, I'm Christopher Perrin. I live here in central Pennsylvania, not far from Harrisburg, the small capital city of the Keystone State. I've been here for about 30 years now. I didn't expect to be in Pennsylvania. I was born in California. I grew up in a military family, spent about 11 years overseas before I was 17 in Asia. But here I am, and I found myself studying history and classics in college because I loved them. Didn't plan to do that. Just kind of found those disciplines and enjoyed them. Didn't know what I was going to do. And then I ended up following kind of my interests and loves. And I ended up going to seminary because I wanted to know more about scripture. And I was interested in philosophy and theology, languages, and I ended up studying apologetics, and I did a PhD in apologetics because it, mainly, again, out of interest, and I was thinking ministry or academia. I was a college pastor for a while, college and high school pastor for a while, and then surprisingly, again, not something I was planning on, I found myself the founding headmaster of a classical Christian school in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Most of us in my generation who got involved in classical Christian education we'll probably say something like this: we didn't go looking for it, but it found us. And then we ended up, you know, become a part of this renewal. And that was, for me, that started in 1997. The founding board of that school, Covenant Christian Academy, interviewed me in August, and I started in September. And I did that for 10 years and really cut my teeth in education and leading a school and, you know, the classical tradition and pedagogy and so on. And then about 2001, some teachers and I there decided that we would start a small little publishing company, mainly because we wanted to produce a Latin and logic text. And that first Latin text was called Latin for Children, the first primer. And then the next book we produced was called The Art of Argument, a study of the informal fallacies. And that led to something else I wasn't expecting to do, which was going into publishing. And I've done that since 2001. And that's led me to just be a part of this very exciting renewal of Christian liberal arts education, or sometimes we call it classical education. The word, by the way, classical education, it's got it's ambiguous. It's got its problems, but there, I don't know of a better word other than to say it's traditional, historical Christian liberal arts education and associated pedagogies. That's what we're doing. It's the education that we've received as an inheritance from our brothers and sisters who've gone before us. And we're just trying to renew it with integrity. It's never really completely disappeared. It's just been kind of fragmented. And we're trying to pull those pieces together now. So that's been kind of my career for the last 25 years, has been a part of that renewal, first as a headmaster, then as a publisher. And I get to do a little bit of teaching here and there on the conference circuit, or I co-teach with my wife a course on virtue, the virtue tradition at Messiah University. And I have a family. So I have three kids. They're all grown. We're just talking about my oldest daughter, who did graduate from Grove City, where apparently your wife attended. And so I have a daughter, Zoe, a daughter, Ellie, and a son, Noah. And my wife is Christine. She's a poet and a literature professor. And we live here in central Pennsylvania.
Excellent. Man, hearing you talk about all this classical Christian education makes me want to go back in time and learn all these things that I should have learned years ago. But yeah, it's a beautiful thing. So thankful for the work that you've done. I know my wife and I were just looking at your book the other day, of sort of the, can't remember what it's called, but the, you know, required reading list for, you know, different ages and, you know, up through high school and probably even on to college. And these are just such important works that we want to pass on to our children and have them sort of take in themselves. So today's topic, there's so many different things that we could cover with you, Dr. Perrin. And the one that I wanted to really hone in on is logic. I know this is a passion of yours. You know, I've never taken a logic class, but it seems like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, it just seems like one of those gaping holes in education generally, and definitely for me specifically. I don't really know that I have the tools that it takes to make a good syllogism or a good argument or whatever. I'm not even sure of all the terms, but could you just give us, like, when you use the term logic, what do you mean by that? And then also give us a sort of an overview of why it's so important, you know, in our education and specifically in family life.
Okay, sure. You know, logic is one of the liberal arts, one of the traditional seven liberal arts. And it's grouped in the first three, which are traditionally called the trivium. And trivium just means threefold path. The threefold path to what? Well, a threefold path to wisdom, to growing as a human being. And those first three verbal arts were grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And to study grammar, logic, and rhetoric is to study what it means to be someone who uses language, someone who speaks. And, you know, being made in the image and likeness of God, he speaks, he uses language, and so do we. And so we're like God in this respect. And so we therefore experience a kind of satisfaction or even joy when we use language well, when we communicate with language. Grammar is a study of how words fit together to form meaning so that we can express our thoughts clearly and accurately, perhaps briefly and pithily, meaningfully. So grammar enables us to access texts and read them and understand them and to write with clarity so that others can understand us well. And logic is the study of how words are used to communicate truth. Logic is the study of how reason works. What is reason? It's a study, you might say, of our own mind. And again, in this respect, we are like God. God uses logic. You use the word syllogism, and syllogism is a fancy sounding word, but it's very simple. It just, in Greek, it means with logic. Syn in Greek means with, so it means with logic. What do you do with logic, and what do you make with logic? What do you make with grammar? Well, with grammar, you make things out of language. You make paragraphs. You can make books. You can make novels. You can make essays. Anything that's made out of language, you would use grammar. By the way, grammar just comes from the Greek word gramma, which means letter. So letters come together to form words, and words to form sentences and thoughts and so on. And grammar has some various principles and rules, like subjects, verbs, and objects, and so on, the parts of speech. And these grammatical rules and principles are true across all languages, whether it's English, Latin, Greek, French, German, Hebrew. And so to study grammar is to study how the structure of language works. Logic is to study language relative to how we make arguments. And so that word artist, why are these arts called arts? Why are they liberal arts? Because arts make you into a maker, because an artifact is something made. So when you think of visual arts and painting, you know, or drawing with a pencil, we understand that. Well, what do you make with these arts? Well, you make arguments out of logic. And rhetoric is the art of persuasive speaking and writing, because you can win an argument and not change a person's mind. Have you ever noticed that?
Yes.
Maybe with your own children, maybe yourself, when you realize that I can't answer that person's argument. He's beat me in the logical realm, but I'm not going to change my mind. I'm still not convinced, because humans are not just logic machines. We're not just logical. We're also poetic. We're imaginative. And so rhetoric recognizes this, that rhetoric, according to Cicero, is the art of moving, persuading. To move and instruct, inspire. So how do I move you? How do I get you to actually change the way you think or do something? Well, that's the study of rhetoric. And of course, it involves logic and it involves grammar. And that's one reason why rhetoric often would follow first the study of grammar and logic, usually in that sequence of grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Not always, right, but usually.
Right.
So logic, and by the way, why are these called liberal arts? Why aren't they called sciences? Why are they liberal? Because they impart to you liberty to make things that you otherwise couldn't make. They're making you more human, therefore. You know, the frog says, "Lord, you made me to jump, and how I love to jump." And the human says, "You made me to speak, and how I love to speak. You made me to reason, and how I love to reason." So logic is a study of our own mind, how we reason. And syllogism is a phrase, a word that describes an argument that consists of three statements, two premises and a conclusion, because this is the way reason works. And if you haven't studied logic, you might not know this formally, but you certainly know it experientially. I'll give you an example, one of the famous examples you read in logic books. All men are mortal, or let's put it this way, all men die. Socrates is a man. What follows from that?
Socrates will die.
Yes. Okay, you've got a universal proposition that's true, stating a general claim. Everybody in the set of men will die. Socrates is in that set. He's one of that set. He's a particular who's a part of that universal set. Therefore, what's true of the universal set is true of him. He will die. You can perceive that as true without maybe using fancy words to describe it. A major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion that necessarily follows. But there are forms of logic that's a valid syllogism. It actually works. But here would be an example of a syllogism that's not valid. All men die. Socrates dies. Therefore, Socrates is a man. It sounds plausible, doesn't it? All men die. Socrates dies. Therefore, Socrates is a man.
Right. But that conclusion doesn't follow from those two premises necessarily.
That's right. Because what if Socrates is a cat?
Right.
Okay. So there's ways in which that's called affirming the consequence. And there's other ways that syllogisms can be valid or invalid. And by the way, they can be sound or unsound. I'll give you an example of a valid syllogism that is not sound. All poodles speak German. Fluffy is a poodle. Therefore, Fluffy speaks German. That follows the same logic of the first syllogism.
But the first premise can't be shown as true necessarily.
Yes, that's why it's unsound, because one of the premises is not true.
Right.
It just happens not to be true that all poodles speak German. So right. You can have a valid syllogism, but if one of the premises isn't true, you say it's unsound. But the structure is still valid.
Right.
And if the premise was true, it would also be sound. Okay, so that's formal logic.
Gotcha.
Then there's, we call that kind of logic formal. I'm just giving you a few examples because it has to do with the form that arguments take. These three statement forms that we call syllogisms. And all reason works this way. You can look at various arguments and then look for the forms that they take and abstract the form from an argument you might be hearing in everyday speech, and then analyze it to see what the logical form is, what the flow is, and look for validity or soundness and so on. That can be helpful. There's another branch of logic that's typically called informal logic, which means we're not focusing on the forms. We're focusing on the other ways, particularly that logic can go awry apart from form when people introduce things that are not relevant into an argument. That's not so much about form. It's more about distracting from the issue at hand. And that
red herring. Yeah,
that's a logical fallacy.
Sure. Yeah.
So there are lots of fallacies of relevance. For example, a very common one in our political debate today is just to abuse the person, call people a loser and this and that and the other thing. Had nothing to, are you really going to listen to what Senator Johnson says? Do you know that Senator Johnson was convicted of two DUIs when he was in college? And you want to listen to his proposal for military spending? Really? I was like, well, that's irrelevant, right? He's got an argument. Do you want to deal with his argument or do you want to just dredge up something from his past? That's called ad hominem abusive, abusing the man while ignoring the argument.
Right.
And it's a fallacy of relevance. And there are many of them. You mentioned red herrings. So it's just throwing something into the argument. It has nothing to do with what you're really discussing.
Right. Right.
Then there are arguments of presumption. When people just presume things like if I say, Graham, are you going to stop cheating on your income taxes? When are you going to stop doing that? Well, I'm already presuming something that's not valid. I'm actually making an accusation, hidden accusation by asking the question.
Right.
That's called a fallacy of presumption. I'm presuming something that is illegitimate. Mm-hmm. Then there's fallacies of clarity. When we use words in muddled ways, an example of that would be, I'm a son of God. We're all sons of God. So what's so special about Jesus? He's a son of God. I'm a son of God. That's what Jesus is teaching. Wait a minute. No, you're using the word son of God in two different senses, right?
Right.
Or if I were to say, I'm an advocate of the liberal arts, and you might respond by saying, I thought you were more a conservative person.
Okay, you need to define our terms, right?
Yeah, we're confused about what the word liberal means because it can mean different things in different senses.
Sure, right.
So you studied liberal arts at Grove City College. I thought Grove City was a more conservative college.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. And what? One more. Can you talk about the fundamental attribution fallacy? I love this. I just learned about this about 6 months ago. I thought this was fascinating.
Yeah. It's when you just assume. It's kind of like assuming the worst of other people. Like when you are speeding on the highway, you've got a good reason.
I got a great reason. But that guy, just a jerk, right?
But anybody else you see speeding is a jerk. And there's all kinds of biases that can creep into our thinking as human beings. Because we're, again, as human beings who I believe are fallen, have the problem with selfishness. we are going to be tempted to use logic to make errors of logic and to fall into fallacies. Even when we're well-meaning, we can do this. And of course, when we're not well-meaning, even all the more likely to introduce fallacies. So we think, and I'm speaking for our company, Classical Academic Press, we publish a couple of books on logic, and we think that studying logic is important, especially informal logic first. Both formal and informal are important, but we like to lead with teaching the logical fallacies. And in our book, The Art of Argument, we introduce 28 common fallacies grouped according to these three major categories of fallacies of relevance, fallacies of presumption and clarity. And then we teach students that it's always important to ask the question, what is the issue you're talking about? And let's stick to it if we can. What is the issue? Because often when you're discussing an issue and you're advocating a particular point of view, if you feel like you're getting the worst of the argument, what's a good strategy? Change the topic.
Change the subject, exactly, yeah.
I'm not really comfortable. Let's just change the topic. And So the issue can be slippery. And that's when people can introduce fallacies is a way of avoiding the issue and not staying with the issue. So it teaches students to ask, what is the issue? And then is the argument I'm hearing relevant to that issue or not? Because if it's not relevant, it might be a fallacy of relevance.
Right.
Or is the argument I'm hearing presuming something that's just not justified in the argument? Then it might be a fallacy of presumption. Or is the argument introducing something that's not clear, that's creating confusion? Then it might be a fallacy of clarity. Here's another example of a common fallacy of accent. Actually, Graham, 3 out of 4 doctors recommend that you should get a dog and walk with this dog every day for health. What study said that? And 3 or 4, or, actually, 94.3% of all college freshmen want to do a humanities major, but then will change their major into a science major or a business major. Did you know that? There's a lot of ways that we use statistics that are, there's this famous saying, liars figure and figures lie. You have to be careful about how people use statistics.
Oh yeah,
and how you accent the way you accent something. Another fallacy of accent would be, a really bad movie came out, but in some review it said something like bold. Use the word bold. This is a bold movie. Well, the quotation was actually, this movie was bold in introducing the most ridiculous actors and the most ridiculous plot imaginable. A very bold movie. You should go see it.
Right.
Choosing to lift out one thing and neglecting the other.
Right. And the statistics one makes me laugh. Is I think about some of those ads from the whatever 30s or 40s. It's 7 out of 10 doctors recommend this type of cigarette.
I'd like to go talk to you. Yeah. So anybody can create a survey. Like here's another example that could be funny. And you can have fun with these fallacies, by the way. Like, I'm a publisher, so our company publishes books. So why wouldn't we create our own little contest for, rating the best logic book out there? And I could say, actually, the National Logic Survey indicates that Art of Argument is the by far the best book on the informal fallacies that exist right now. Well, who ran that National Logic Survey? Well, Graham and Chris did. And who took the survey? Well, their relatives. So you have to always, we know to question these things and
sure,
so on. But informal logic is fun. Students enjoy it. Informal logic, the study of the logical fallacies, is something that we experience in daily life. We experience it in print advertisement. We experience it in movie reviews. We experience it in political speech and discussions around the family dinner table, because we're all prone to these fallacies. We've experienced them regularly. So a kid at around 12 or 13 generally enjoys studying logic because it's relevant to his life. It's fun. And at about that time, his brain is starting to lead him to think more and more logically. So it feels right. Like Yeah, it's almost like a kid who wants to study self-defense. At a certain age, my son wanted to wrestle me. And at another age, you know, he was ready to actually be instructed in, you know, martial arts.
Sure.
Learning judo or something. So it's like teaching a teenager judo, mental judo, to yes. protect themselves from the propaganda that's out yes. there.
Yes.
And to examine their own heart and life to make ensure that they're not falling into fallacies.
Yes. Oh, that's so good. Yeah, I love this. I mean, it's like you mentioned, it's fun. But I wanted to dive into that point about it being useful, especially mm-hmm. as it relates to family life. You know, we're always talking on the podcast about, you know, how to be a strategic family. Obviously, it's the title of the podcast. So I wonder if you could take some of these concepts, because I just find this whole thing fascinating, and how we can use it within our families and then also to help our kids. Because as you mentioned, I'm so glad you mentioned propaganda. And it's not just propaganda. It's all kinds of nonsense that they're going to hear from the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we could as parents, and I think there's some good tendencies in this, you know, we want to protect our kids, shield them from some of this stuff. And of course, in age-appropriate ways, we do need to shield them. We need to be careful about what comes into their brains. But at a certain point, like you mentioned, maybe it's 10, 11, 12, 13, whatever, they're going to go out in the world and they're going to encounter some of this stuff. And I love how some of these tools that you're talking about can be super, super useful and not getting sucked into some of the world's thinking, and so that they can soundly identify what's true and what's not and what they need to question. And I mean, it's just such a healthy thing for a kid to go through. So can you talk about how can parents start to like use these concepts and help their kids along in them?
Absolutely. Because logic is so human. This is why it's a liberal art. It describes what it means to be fully human. And so to learn logic or grammar or rhetoric, and by the way, you have to learn the mathematical arts, same thing applies, because we also reason using number. We quantify as well as qualify. We weigh, we measure, we ponder. These things include the mathematical arts, grammar of arithmetic, astronomy, music, geometry. And so the mathematical arts and the verbal arts together enable us to become fully human. If you think about it from, say, the Genesis narrative, what was Adam doing? He was learning using language and number, right? When he was naming the animals, he had to observe them and give them names. And he would have noticed that, you know, the elephant had four legs and one trunk, and so forth. And so all of these things are, and was heavy. These things were the mathematical arts and the verbal arts together help us to grow into a full humanity. And notice that this is something we see in creation. It's something that is a part of our being in the image and likeness of God, which means that even people outside of the church should receive training in the liberal arts. But the liberal arts come into their own when they are qualified by Christian love. Mm-hmm. When we use these arts to the glory of God, to love God and to serve our yes. neighbor, then that's why Christian liberal arts is, you know, is also a part of our tradition in the church. Right. But yes, it's so practical because it's so human. I'll just give you one example that comes to mind. Going back to the fallacies of clarity, I use the example of liberal being a word that can be equivocal. We can use that word in different senses, right? So liberal arts, liberal politics, you know, a liberal democracy, being liberal in your spending. Four different senses right there. And if in an argument we use it in different senses, or if we're unclear, we're not sure what. We could be misunderstood, or right. maybe we're intentionally right. being ambiguous.
Yes, they might as well be different words.
Yes, but right now with transgenderism and gender fluidity, this is an example right. of fallacies of clarity. Matt Walsh has been camping out on this because he's noted this. What is a woman? When someone says, I'm transitioning to becoming a woman. All right. Well, what is a woman? What is it that you're transitioning to? Could you define that, please? No one wants to define it. Even one of our Supreme Court justices said she wouldn't define what a woman was because she wasn't a biologist.
Right.
Well, I think our biologists can tell us what a woman is, and then we can learn from our biology teachers.
Right.
But apparently no, that's still too difficult. We better bring a biologist to the Senate hearing. So there's just a perfect example there of our culture refusing to define a word, because if you define it, it will contradict your politics.
Right. Right. And you probably remember in What Is a Woman, one of the most striking scenes, actually, this ties in perfectly with our discussion about logic, because he interviewed someone and said, you know, what is a woman? And the person said, well, I think only a woman could give you a definition. And he goes, are you a cat? No. Can you tell me what a cat is? Can only cats tell us what a cat? I mean, it's absurd, but he was using some of these tools to say, like, just think about it. Like, you have to think about what you're saying, because it sounds on the surface. And this is where I think it can be so intensely useful for kids. It sounds like a nice thing to say, but when you actually go into the details, it's patently absurd. And these are some of the tools we can give our kids.
So often, and we do this in our book as well, and so do other books, but when you start an argument, words need to be defined. You need to define your terms. So if you're arguing that anyone can become a woman, then is it, okay, great. What do you mean by anyone? You mean any human being? Okay, how do you define human? I mean, some of these you would think were just understood, but right now they're not. So what do you mean by anyone? You mean human beings? Okay, and what is a human being? Okay, we can find this. So, all right. And you say anyone can become a woman. So, okay, what is a woman? And right there, that's where they will see that the logic is going to challenge their conclusion. So
sure.
Then, and we do this too. I don't just want to pick on those transgenderists. Transgender advocates. Any of us can fall in. We're prone to error, but this happens to be one common error that's not being questioned. And our journalists, generally speaking, are the authorities in media are not equipped to interrogate this issue and to point this out.
Right.
In other words, they are duped by the fallacy.
Right.
So, and this is why when people are asked, well, then what is a woman? They'll say things like, well, what do you think a woman is? Like, let's just dodge the question.
Right.
Or they'll say it's whatever you want it to be. And they'll find a way of refusing to answer. And one person in this documentary, I think said, I find your question hostile. Well, that's irrelevant. Maybe it is hostile. Maybe it's revealing all kinds of terrible things about me. Let's right. assume that's true.
Right.
But now would you answer the question? What is a woman?
Right. Right.
I don't think I should have to answer a question that's so hostile. Okay. Well, if someone else can ask it, I think that person thinks that the question, no matter who asked it, doesn't deserve to be answered.
Right.
And that's his way of avoiding the inevitable consequence that would contradict his politics. So
sure.
That's just one example of many, right? So if you happen to have watched the last presidential debate between Biden and Trump, it was the worst, it wasn't a debate. it was just a throwing accusation of barbs.
Right.
And the poor facilitator was just trying to, it was terrible. And what it reveals right now about our politics is not comforting at all.
Right. But
let me go back to something else. Logic comes from the word logos. And logos is a very rich Greek word that defies a translation by a single English word. So we might translate it logic, but it can be translated in so many other ways. In John's gospel, we read, in arche en ho logos, kai ho logos en proston theon, kai theos en ho logos, which is, in the beginning was the word, the logos, and the logos was with God, and the logos was God. So John is using the word logos, from which, and logos can mean word, it can mean logic, it can mean reason, it can mean communication, it can mean so many different things, but you can see their relationship. You know, in the beginning was the word. There were other words for word. Rhema is another word commonly used in Greek in the Gospels to refer to a word. You know, when God speaks, the word rhema. But logos, John chose to use logos, which is a deeper, richer word. The argument of God, the reason of God, the communication of God, the word of God. You know, that's Christ.
Right.
And so what I'm getting at here is that to use logic is to be tied in already to who Christ is. Because all reason, all truth is rooted in Jesus Christ, who is the way, the truth, and the life. And so anybody who is using logic and using reason is already doing it derivatively from, they're already in touch in some way with the truth, seeking truth. If if logic is to be used to seek truth, if we've been given minds, reason, such that we can seek and find that which is true, then anybody who seeks and finds something that is true, even outside of the church, is already in contact with the one who is the truth.
Right.
And this is why we who are Christians and know Christ and, you know, redemptively can appeal to reason as a way of saying, you already know something of this God.
Mm.
You already, the fact that you're breathing is a gift from him.
Yes.
The fact that you're using your mind and you enjoy using your mind, you love coming to conclusions, whether you're a scientist or a philosopher, it is already a call to you to return to your creator who's given you logic. In fact, when Christ reveals himself, he is called the logic of God.
Mm.
You know, he's the logos.
Mm.
So there's also behind all of this kind of mental work and descriptions, there's a spiritual dimension present.
Yes.
And I think it's worth bringing these up to our children around the dinner table, you know, that to use your mind is to glorify God and to enjoy him. So, you know, Matthew 22, where the Lord says, you know, the two great commandments, which we should probably pay attention to when Christ says, these are two things you should really know. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So logic can be a way of enjoying our Lord, and a way of frolicking with him. And not just a dry, abstract study.
Yeah, right.
In fact, we should therefore, as we're using our mind, because there's a spiritual dimension, and because we're so prone to error, we should be calling out to God, even as we're reasoning, for direction and protection and help. The use of our reason is subject to our spiritual condition.
Yes.
So it should be infused with a matter of prayer. In fact, you find this in the classical Christian tradition. There's a writer named A.G. Certalange. He says that study is a prayer to the truth.
Mm.
You know, so whenever you're studying something, it's a kind of prayer.
Mm.
You're trying to understand something, and you're using, of course, your reason, trying to fit things together. That itself is attention, and attention is already a kind of prayer.
Mm.
So can you imagine raising up your kids thinking that, you know, before we even begin studying today, we should call upon the Lord for illumination.
Mm.
Show me if there is any anxious way in me. Lead me in the everlasting way. Illumine my mind. Remove the scales from my eyes that I might see wonderful things from your law.
Mm.
To study scripture, to study anything, requires, well, the absence of blindness. You see this in Luke chapter 6, for example, and I think it's a great place to go for parents around the dinner table and so on.
Mm.
It's where Jesus says a student is not above his teacher, but a student, when he's been fully trained, will be like his teacher.
Mm.
And then he says, you know, right before that, he says, if a blind man leads a blind man, will they not both not fall into a pit? And these two things are together in a kind of antithetical relationship. These two lines interpret one another. So a blind man leads a blind man, they both fall into a pit. But a teacher, when a student's been fully trained, he will be like his teacher. What do those two things have to do with one another? Well, a teacher is the opposite of a blind man.
Right.
A teacher is somebody who's been there and seen it and can guide you and help you to see. And there's a sense in which all learning is a kind of seeing. We use the metaphor of our eyes or our senses to describe understanding. We often say, I see what you're saying now. Now I see it. I see it. You see it with your mind's eye. But then right after this passage, where does Jesus go? He says, before you would deign to try to pull the speck from your brother's eye, take the 2x4 out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to pull the speck out of your brother's eye.
Yeah.
And so what he's saying is, we have to be daily repenting in order to be a teacher. Yeah. If I'm going to even be able to show my daughter or my son or a student some truth, I have to have a single clear eye myself, so that my whole body will be full of light. Another place where Jesus speaks about
this.
So these things are related, I believe, to using our minds. We're to use our minds to love God, love the Lord your God with all your mind. We're to do it by daily repenting, by pulling the plank out of our eyes so that we can see, so that we can help our children to see. And by the way, going back to that idea of a guide, a blind guide, a teacher is like a guide who says, follow me. I'm going to show you what I have seen before, but it's not enough for me to see it and to tell you about it.
They need to see it.
You have to see it with your own eyes. And that's the way logic works, right? I can't just tell you that this syllogism is true. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. You have to see it. And when you see it and you can say, oh, I get it. I see it. Now you've learned something. You've encountered some truth yourself. And it now belongs to you. And you can say, it's no longer something that you've just told me about. I have seen it for myself and I myself know.
Yes.
And now this truth is possessed in me and it's a part of me. And now I can share it with someone else and help them to see too.
Yeah.
And if you could indulge me in one more metaphor, it's like Andrew going to Nathaniel in John chapter 1 and saying, I've met this the Messiah. Come and see. Come and see.
Love that.
So, you know, Andrew knew, I can't just, you got to experience this yourself. You have to see Jesus.
Yes.
And then you remember that great scene where Nathaniel says, he's Jesus of Nazareth. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? And then Jesus says to him, you know, Nathaniel, you know, before you came here, I saw you under the fig tree. You know, so it's like Jesus sees everything.
Yeah.
And
yes.
And once you realize he can see me under the fig tree, he can see me everywhere. Here's the one who's all seeing, all knowing. He is the great teacher. He is the great guide, capital T, capital G. I want him to show me so that I can see too.
Right.
So logic, spiritually speaking, is a kind of seeing, and there's a spiritual dimension present too.
Right. I'm reminded of one of my favorite verses, John 17:17. I think this is in the high priestly prayer where Jesus says, sanctify them by the truth. Your word is truth. So there's a sanctifying element in studying his truth. And it's beautiful, beautiful. Well, I want to quote you because you said something in one of your podcast episodes that has stuck with me ever since you said it. And I think it's so applicable here as we think about using language and helping our kids use language well. And you were giving an example of, you were saying, you know, whether you know it or not, you're a language artist. We're all language artists. If you use language, you're a language artist. And you said, even if it's something as simple as, you know, what movie are you and your friends going to go see? And then you said this a couple of times. You said, you know, when it comes to language, you're either doing it well or poorly or somewhere in between. And there's something about when you said that, it just struck me. I was like, yes, we want our children to do it. We want to do it well, and we want our children to do it well. And so you could say, oh, you know, I don't know what a syllogism is. I didn't study logic. Like, no, time out. No, this is intensely useful for your life and the life of your family to be able to use language well. And when you said that, it just kind of brought it into focus for me, I guess, that like, yeah, we could neglect the study of, you know, making a good case and identifying fallacies. We could neglect that, but we do so at the risk of not being effective, not only for, you know, all the things, you know, capitalism and all that. I mean, that's one thing, we can set that aside, but being effective for the gospel, being effective to defend the faith in the marketplace of ideas. So sorry, there's not really a question there, but I love that you said that. And maybe you could just elaborate on that a little bit. How does that work in parenting?
Sure. Let me use another analogy. We all move our bodies. We've been given bodies. We're embodied creatures. And so, you know, if someone were to say, you know, like, I resist the imposition of geography, direction, and compass. I don't want to face north, east, west, or south. I am odd-directional. You don't have a choice. You're embodied and you are facing one direction or the other. You can't,
that's right.
You can't jump out of the compass.
Right.
And so we're going to use our bodies. But we're going to use our bodies either well or not well or somewhere in between. You know, let's just take physical exercise. You are exercising. You get up, you move, you know, your body burns calories just sitting down.
Sure.
But well, how are you using your body? Are you healthy? And then there's a continuum of what would be you know, good use of your body. And we could extend that to some other things like dieting, of course, but just take the physical, because it's part of our humanity. We've been given bodies. How are you using your body? Well, we've also been given language as being a human. We've been given logic, we've been grammar. You know, we have these arts. We exercise these arts, whether we've been trained in them or not. You may not have gotten any, you know, training in language. You know, think about somebody just imitating people who speak English is already training in language just by imitation and practice.
Sure. Yeah.
This is why, you know, with your kids, if they're young, you know, if you were to say to one of your young kids, well, me go to the grocery store now with mommy. They say, no, it's daddy. It's not me go to the grocery store. It's right. I go to the grocery store.
Yeah.
No. Hey, would you give that ball to I? Give that ball to I right now. Daddy, no, just give that ball to me. How do they even know the difference between the subjective and the objective case of those words? They know just by mere observation.
That's right.
They know it sounds wrong to say me go to the grocery store.
Right.
But there are others who don't have that aren't around great English speakers, and they learn other patterns. So you've learned how to speak just by imitation. But what if you were also, and if you've grown up with good English speakers, that's going to help you a lot. But what if you also received training? What if you also studied the art of rhetoric? What if you also had memorized lots of poetry and other great sayings and scripture and so on? Mm. So you could work in great language, the best words in the best order to express yourself. What if you had memorized dozens of proverbs and maxims?
Right.
And what if great passages from literature from your commonplace book? Or what if your dad had done that and was always quoting passages from Tolkien and Lewis and Dickens and so on, like my wife does, because she's a poet. And her father, my father-in-law, who throughout his career had a huge quote notebook, and he's memorized hundreds of quotations and can just ornament his speech with lovely phrases.
Sure, yeah.
Well, that's takes practice and training. And then he was a prosecutor, and he was a very effective orator in the courtroom. Was an English major in college and then went to law school. Okay. So do you want that training or not? And if you get that training, it will help you. It will make you an artist, so that you can make things artistically out of words, no matter what you do.
Right.
And you've mentioned being effective in the marketplace, maybe in, say, Christian apologetics, you know, answering arguments and so on. But what if God calls you to be a carpenter, and that's your main vocation? You will be an interesting carpenter.
And way more effective.
More effective and thoughtful and enjoyable to talk to, sure. As well as an interesting husband, brother, church member, citizen. You know, it just, this is why these arts were considered for every human being. They would benefit and bless every human being, regardless of what your vocation ended up being. They were preparatory studies that could lead you to become a great plumber or professor. It doesn't matter so much where you end up going. And not only will it make you effective, because that's true, it will make you a blessing. Mm. A blessing to others. Mm. And a blessing to yourself.
Yeah.
So I think that's one way to motivate students is to say, this is, you know, you will be like the frog likes to jump. You will like using words well.
Right.
You will like using reason well. You will like learning how to speak in ways that move people and delight people and persuade people. This will be an enjoyment. It's valuable for its own sake. The same way you might want to put flowers on the dinner table, right? You do that for its own sake, the beauty of it, or the reason why you listen to music and enjoy music.
Absolutely, yep.
Because it's a joy.
Yeah.
Not because it's going to make you more money. Like, I listened to this beautiful music last night. Well, why did you do that? How's that going to help you with your job? How's that going to help you economically?
It's not about that, yeah.
It's an end in itself. In fact,
that's right.
The fine arts have this kind of built into it. The word fine comes from finis, which means finish, end.
Right.
You know, fine arts, like music, enjoying a painting, it has no other purpose than
that's right. Right.
That's the end of the line, is to enjoy the flowers on the table, the beautiful music. Now, can someone make a career out of floral arrangement? Sure. Can somebody become a professional musician? Sure. But these arts are also blessings to us in and of themselves, regardless of any utility beyond
them. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's great. I think I remember hearing you say that about the fine arts in one of your podcast episodes. That's beautiful. So, okay. So let's say that we've got parents listening who have kids in the home and they say, all right, you know, this makes perfect sense. Like, I love this. I don't really have the tools myself, but I would love for my kids to have an opportunity to learn this. Where is there like one or two places you'd recommend they start, like a book or a set of videos or an exercise, or, you know, where would you start?
Oh, sure. Like, you know, there are resources out there for adults. There's college level, like the college text I use was, Copy's Logic. You can get these logic books and so on, but it helps to have a teacher. And so I would recommend that you take a look at The Art of Argument. I mentioned that earlier in the podcast, but it's a study of the informal fallacies. It's designed for students who are like in middle school, or maybe, you know, once kids are getting naturally argumentative, I don't mean quarreling, I mean using reason,
sure, yeah,
to seek truth in argument, then it's time. And it's like, now the kid's ready to study judo, ready to study logic. Yep. And that book is a great text for adults as well. Although we are going to be releasing a book that this spring, that is essentially a version of the same 28 fallacies that's designed for adults. And I think we're going to call it That's a Fallacy, a study in logical argumentation or something. Guide for Parents. I don't know what our subtitle will be. And those books would be helpful. But I would encourage you to take a look at the Art of Argument as a first resource. There are other books out there that are good, the adult versions. There's another small book called The Fallacy Detective, which is also a good book. It's a competitive text with ours, but I don't mind mentioning it. It's a good book. There's some websites that you can go to as well, where you can just study the fallacies online. We're going to be releasing a website that is paired with The Art of Argument, because we think it's a helpful kind of complementary way of studying the fallacies.
Yeah.
Those are the first ideas that come to my mind.
Good. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I was thinking here, because, you know, our children are getting into that age when they start to, you know, make arguments, have arguments too, but make arguments. And I was thinking, if we train our kids too well, they might use this against us. So
they will.
But that's a beautiful thing, right? I mean, I have definitely had my son, I think, you know, point out things. I'm like, all right, good point. let me get back to you. But that's a beautiful thing. You know, we can recognize that. Hopefully we can be humble enough as parents to know when our kids have made a good point.
Absolutely. They will. And I think you should encourage that. You know, like, if you, by the way, there's a video resource that comes with The Art of Argument where we have four students interacting with a teacher throughout,
yes,
going through each of the fallacies. But yeah, having students practice on you, and you with them, and learning, you know, once you acquire the basic vocabulary, and any adult, any thoughtful adult already knows something of these fallacies, probably the only thing that's really lacking is a direct study of them and an acquisition of the names for things.
Right.
Like you mentioned syllogism and, you know, words like equivocation and false dilemma and ad hominem fallacy. You know, it's nice to get the names for things you've already experienced. Like, oh yeah, I know that fallacy. I didn't know that was actually a fallacy and that there was a name for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's called begging the question. Oh, why? You know, so learning like any new discipline, there's a vocabulary that comes with it.
Yep.
So when you acquire the vocabulary of the logical fallacies, they become common around your dinner table. And then you know, your mom will say things, your kid will say things like, "Mom, that's an illegitimate appeal to authority." You know, that's false cause.
Yeah.
Dad, that is a sweeping generalization. You know, you want that, right? And you might even want to, what I used to do, purposefully use fallacies around the dinner table.
Yeah. Yeah. See if they get caught, right?
Yeah.
I was thinking, and my wife and I have done this sometimes too. We're watching something together, you know, whether it's a movie or, you know, news clip or something. And it's like, pause. All right, guys.
Yeah.
What did you just hear? What's wrong with what they just said? You know, and just teaching moments, you know, there's all kinds of teaching moments all the time.
Precisely. And the goal here is just like with judo, you know, if you've studied a martial art, you study it enough, the various defensive moves and counters become second nature.
Yes.
Like somebody who's been trained. I took Kung Fu once when I was in Asia for a couple of years, and I'm not very good, but I've just noticed that training has stayed with me. So if somebody kind of comes at me, I'll immediately do this.
You know exactly what to do. Right.
it's just because of all those 2 years of training. It's like combat as well. Like people have been in combat and been trained, or it's like athletics. You know, how do you know to make this move or that move with the basketball and so on? Well, it comes from muscle memory, regular training, or improv, doing improv with music. It's similar. So once someone learns the fallacies really well, when they encounter one, they can on their feet respond.
Right.
And that's what our journalists don't have right now. That's what people can't, like, and most of us are the same way. You'll hear an argument and you'll think to yourself, wait a minute, that something's fishy there. No, that can't be right. But in the moment, you don't know how
to respond. Yeah, exactly. You know, you see the, those sessions of parliament where the prime minister has to come in front of, you know, in the United Kingdom, and they just hammer this guy with questions and he's got to think on his feet. And I've thought so often, man, we need that here. I would love that. And not to pin the president to the ground or whatever, but just have a healthy debate. I mean, what a beautiful thing, instead of just everything being, you know, set piece and, you know, prepared in advance. Sometimes you got to think on your feet. So, anyway,
even, you know, you're referring to the parliamentary form of debate. It's really interesting, but there are other forms of debate that, you know, we just don't do it much anymore, where there would be cross-examination, you know, and there would be opportunity to, and rebuttals, you know, positive statements, rebuttals, cross-examination. Yep. And in those kinds of debates, somebody who's been trained in logic can really shine.
Sure.
But we don't do that. That doesn't happen. It certainly doesn't happen in our political debates. It may happen on some college campuses occasionally, but it's sadly diminished a great deal. We need to recover it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you know, I'm just reminded that the point of all of this is to arrive at the truth and to move people towards the truth. And the ultimate truth is Christ. And that's what we want to do with our language and with our reasoning. And yeah, just really appreciate you helping us see that. This is awesome stuff. And I hope that every parent listening can take a step in this direction, try to find one or more of these resources and just get started on it. Because like you said, it's fun. It's also effective, but like you said, and I love that point you made, it's also a blessing, and we can be a blessing to ourselves and to others by studying these things and taking them seriously. So before I let you go, one last question, is there, you know, just thinking about your own family, we love, you know, here on the podcast, we love learning from those who have, you know, especially those who have kids out of the home, kind of looking back on their parenting journey. You know, nobody's perfect, but I would just love to know if there's a thing or two from you raising, you and Christine raising kids in the home. Is there a thing or two that you're like, man, you know, by God's grace, I'm so glad we did this, that you know, those who are raising kids now can take and possibly put into their rhythms.
Thanks, Graham. Yeah, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. You think, oh, if we could do this over again now, we could do something, we could make some changes. But a couple things come to mind. One is bringing music into the family. You mentioned, you know, music is a fine art. It's also you know, one of the liberal arts, but music opens up so many doors into the soul, and it has a kind of immediate effect on the soul, or can, it's that can lead to other things that are lovely. So singing,
yes,
and music, bringing that into the home, having instruments out. So I'm not a guitarist. I'm a guitar player. I'm not great. I'm kind of
same here.
lifelong in the intermediate state. But someone gave me this tip years ago: get a good guitar. You know, probably a $600 or $700 guitar, not because the cheap ones you can't play easily, or maybe a $500 guitar. But maybe you get it used. But you get a good guitar, and you hang it out, and it's on a stand in a public place. Mm. Same thing with other instruments, and then of course give your children an opportunity to play them and maybe instruction in them, and then that music starts to flow through the house. And things happen. My son is a guitarist and a songwriter, far exceeded me. And it's I think it's in large part because there was always a guitar available, a good guitar,
right,
to play. And then bringing singing into the household as a regular, doing it together. You know, whether you're singing hymns, scripture songs, other music, singing, and then I would also say bringing scripture into the house. And I wish I had done this better earlier, but using God's prayer book, which is the Psalms, let the Psalms just ring through your home as kind of your prayer book, where you would sing the Psalms, read the Psalms, pray the Psalms, read them and pray back to them, memorize portions of them, and then work it into the fabric of your house. And then one contribution from my wife is to do this with poetry, good poetry, that would be read and memorized, recited. You know, your kids might learn music as well, and then you have little miniature recitals in your home.
Yeah,
you know, right. Even when they're not that good yet. If parents can play and play with them and incorporate, you know, then you do, you know, there's something that happens when you sing together or play together. You have to attend to each other. You have to, you have to be in a kind of harmony with one another.
Yes.
You're making something beautiful together. That knits a family together well. So those, and then if you as a parent have studied some art or something that you love, keep doing it in the presence of your kids. So often what's happens is, you know, mom studied the violin in college or something, and then she has a few kids and violin is up in an attic and you never see it again. And then she's sending her kids off to their music lessons and so on, but she's not modeling it. She's just a facilitator.
Right,
what our children need to see is mommy's going to her music lesson now. She's still growing. She's still learning. She still has something she's excited about, rather than giving all of those things up. And if dad was a soccer player, why does he stop playing soccer?
Yeah.
You know, he needs to be a coach, or he needs to be on a men's rec team. You know, dad's going to a soccer game.
Yeah.
Dad's going to his guitar lesson, or what is dad doing right now? Well, this is the time where he's working on his novel. He's writing poetry, whatever it is that you do. He's in the workshop, the woodshop, he's building a cabinet. Whatever it is that you used to do that you loved, don't stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You might have to slow it down, but keep it alive so that you're not just the guy who goes to work every day and then comes home and does nothing else except, you know, clean up the house and have dinner. And, you know, what is it that's enriching your life that you're not even teaching your kids yet, but they just see you doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Modeling it.
That's really good. Oh, that's excellent. Yeah. And I think, and a lot of times, can't do this with everything, but a lot of times you can do that thing and then just bring a kid along with you or have them sitting right there. I mean, in those times can be so wonderful and surprising. Like you didn't, you know, you thought it was going to slow you down. You thought it was going to be frustrating, but you get to teach and you get to see a spark in their eye and you get to pass something on just by modeling it. And it can be.
That reminds me of one other thing. Yeah, mom and dad should be reading books together that the kids are not reading yet. You know, you can't do as much as you'd like, I know.
Sure.
But let's say that you and your wife are reading A Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah.
And the kids are doing other things. And you might be reading what the kids are, you're teaching. But then they see you and your wife talking about A Tale of Two Cities. They're like,
yeah,
what are you doing? Well, we're reading this book. What's it about? You know, and that model, that's such important modeling. Mom and dad are studying and reading and doing their own work that someday I will join them in doing. And I'm hearing about it. I'm watching it. But right now I'm reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I'm not doing The Tale of Two Cities.
Right.
You'll do that in high school maybe. But
But
they need to see you growing as students in front of them.
Yes.
And pursuing your own arts and your own loves to the degree that's reasonable in front of them. But then they begin to see that that's what life should be in their own homes and their own lives.
Yep.
It's not all work, 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 work. It's enjoying these arts and gifts.
Yeah. And it's not even all just teaching. It's like you mentioned, lifelong, being a lifelong student, lifelong learning. And that's, my wife and I have talked about this before. I feel like that's one of the greatest things we can pass on to them as kids in our home, is that learning is a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. And it's not just for school. It is a lifelong thing. And that's not just even school learning too. That's studying your wife, you know, that's studying, you know, the beauty and purity of the church and all these wonderful things. Like, we want to continue to be students. So yeah, couldn't agree more. That's awesome. Well, last question. Mm-hmm. Some people are going to want to follow you and learn more about you and your ministry and Classical Academic Press. How can they follow you? How can they learn more?
Oh, thanks, Graham. You can find me a podcast. I do a podcast called The Christopher Perrin Show. Talk about education and culture and great ideas. And I do. I also have a podcast with Searcy Institute called Cafe Scholae. Which I need to resume. I've got to owe them a few podcast episodes. Yeah. And then you can also find me on classicalu.com, where it's a teacher training platform for classical educators and homeschool educators. And I have there's 80 courses there, and I teach about 4 of them. I'm on Twitter. I don't tweet that often. I'm on Facebook. Those are the places where you can find me. And of course, you mentioned Classical Academic Press, which is just at classicalacademicpress.com. You can find our curriculum and monographs there.
Excellent. Well, yeah, highly endorse your podcast, The Christopher Perrin Show. Loved it. I've passed it on to a couple of my friends so far. I mean, I really feel like I'm going to a college course that I ever went to. And it's an awesome thing. So, well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you
for sharing all this wisdom. This has been so much fun, and blessings to you and your family.
Likewise, blessings to you. And it's been an honor to be on your podcast. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Dr. Perrin, thank you so much for this excellent wisdom. What great ideas to help us in our parenting. And it's been such a blessing to learn from you on these incredibly important topics. Okay, parents, what do you say? Let's do this. Let's start by learning about logic and how we can bring it to bear on how we raise our kids. It's an excellent way to help them not only combat lies, but embrace the truth. All right, so my song recommendation for this week is called Endless Praise by an artist named Charity Gayle. That's G-A-Y-L-E. My kids and I have been listening to the song in the car recently, and it is just an awesome song, an amazing expression of worship to our Savior, Jesus Christ. Okay, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.